Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
This is Center Court with Hall of Fame basketball player Ralph Sampson. Center Court is presented by the Winner's Circle Network in conjunction with the Sampson Family Foundation, striving to uplift, empower, and educate the communities we live in. Now here's Ralph and your host, Mac McDonald.
Welcome in Center Court with Ralph Sampson. I'm Mac McDonald. It's another week and a lot of hot topics, Ralph. And we're going to dive into free agency today and where free agency really started. It began with some very big names. How are you? And I do want to talk free agency with you because you experienced it, didn't you?
Yeah, I spent a little bit of it. I got traded. My contract was getting ready to be up. I just got hurt the previous year. I came back, I played, and then they traded me, and then I got to be a free agent and try to test the waters after that. Mm-hmm. But it's free agent is crazy. It's more crazy now than it was then because, you know, they did some shyster things back in the day.
Sure.
And today is even more shysterous, but at least you know and the players know what their market value is and can dictate, like LeBron James, dictate where I want to go and where I don't want to go.
Mm-hmm. And it affected your senior year, right? Wasn't there something going with the Rockets? You were going to be paid a minimum, and correct me if I'm wrong, it was going to be around $40,000, right? If you would have come out your senior year and not stayed one more year at UVA. Is that right?
Yeah, no, that was so my senior year. The problem was that I did not, I mean, my junior year, I didn't know I would may have come out. I didn't know if I was going to be able to go to the Rockets or Indiana or the 76ers because
right.
They had traded Moses Malone from Houston to Philly. And that's when they won the championship with Julius Erving that year. So it was up in the air my junior year because I didn't know what I was going to do. But there was some money thrown out as far as if I came out. You know, there was agents and teams were going through the agents saying, you know, you come out, they'll give you this, that, and the other. So I had all kinds of situations going on between my junior and senior year to come out of school for sure.
You had a lot of input, right? Not only from Terry Holland, and you had some good legal minds as well, but wasn't your mom very important in all the discussions, your mom and dad?
Yeah, I mean, Coach Holland actually just guided me through. And I mean, every year just say, you know, you got to do what's best for you. I mean, obviously we want you to stay. Mm-hmm. And I think they were sweating bullets a little bit the first number of years, but he just kind of was a father figure and not putting pressure on me as far as to stay or to go. Gave me all the resources that I needed to make a decision. One of those years, I just got away from UVA. And me, Doug Newberg, Brent Johnson, a bunch of us got in my car. And we drove to Fort Lauderdale, just hung out for 4 or 5 days just to get away from the craziness.
Right.
And then we went back up to the Philadelphia series and saw that a little bit at that point in time. And so, you know, he gave me the free reign to do that. And my mom and dad basically said, you know, let's just do what's best for what you want to do at that point in time. I always would ask them, do we need anything? Is it financially stable? And then they always say, well, we worked this many years. We'll continue to work no matter what you do and how you get it done. So I had very good people around me and then very good advice. And I contacted a couple of friends that were lawyers, that were around the family, around hometown. But nobody pressured me to do anything.
That's all good. Today, our discussion is about Curt Flood and Oscar Robertson and how they changed the sporting world and what's going to happen with the PGA Tour. That's next on Center Court on the Winner's Circle Network. During Ralph Sampson's Hall of Fame career, he always believed dedication and teamwork were the two main ingredients for success. Now, with the opening of his restaurant in Charlottesville, the American Tap Room is proving great food can happen in an upscale sports bar atmosphere. Ralph Sampson's American Tap Room features local eats, local brews, and traditional favorites like burgers, wings, steaks, and seafood. You'll love the lobster mac and cheese and the Bourbon Street pasta. There's even a Coach Bennett ribeye. The Tap Room is now open for lunch from 11 to 4, and the staff serves dinner from 4 to 10. Reservations are accepted, and you can book parties up to 150 people. Contact General Manager Martin Welch at 434-422-8093. Ralph Sampson's American Tap Room, a hometown bar and grill brought to you by a hometown hero.
I think a good team has a good spirit, and vice versa. You know, it's very difficult to say which comes first. I think you have to have the talent, though, in order to have a good ball team. And when you win, you develop a real good, close relationship and good spirit with your ball club.
You're listening to Center Court with Hall of Fame basketball player Ralph Sampson. Once again, here's Ralph and Mac.
Welcome back, Center Court on the Winner's Circle Network. And today we're talking free agency, what has happened in the world of sports, and what is happening now, and of course, Ralph's experience with everything. Ralph, I want to talk about Curt Flood a little bit, way before your time, not my time, but Curt Flood was very, very instrumental in getting baseball and the reserve clause changed. His first court trial was in 1970 in Manhattan, and the path for Curt Flood was not going to be easy.
The lawyers for the major leagues would not talk for the cameras, but in the courtroom, they argued that the reserve clause is essential to the future of organized baseball, that without the reserve clause, all the rich teams would get all the star players. But Arthur Goldberg maintains that the reserve clause, tying a player to one team for the rest of his life, is in violation of the 13th Amendment. That's the amendment against slavery and indentured servitude.
No active players testified in his defense. And, you know, he lost in district court, then again in the Court of Appeals. And Ralph, in 1972, the Supreme Court ruled against Flood and his challenge, and the vote was 5-3. Now, who would have thought at that time, right, with antitrust laws and the reserve clause was still in effect? When we were talking first segment about the people walking you through what you are going to experience, whether you come out at Virginia, do you remember the words free agency and reserve clause coming into some of the talks and the contract talks that you were facing?
Yeah, I mean, you think about that, the statement that the lawyer made there, or whoever was presenting it, that the clauses and the most teams with the most money, and then the powerful teams and slavery, if you have somebody there for their whole career. I mean, the most valuable teams in the NBA today, you know, or the NFL or baseball still have a market value, and the owners know that. Lakers and Boston and Chicago, all the teams that are, you know, I mean, the Houston Rockets sold for $2.2 billion. So they got a powerful team, so they got to make money. They got to have some good players because they value their asset.
Mm-hmm.
And when they value the asset, they have to understand that that's the way the market is, right? So you got to have good players in those markets so the owners can compete. But also now they do a lot of revenue sharing. So it's a totally different animal at this point in the NBA or baseball as well. But free agency is crazy. I mean, I'll give you another story, Mac, with not this Curt Flood thing, which is kind of crazy that he had to go to the Supreme Court and really take it to the highest court in the land to figure it out and still got denied. Chris Paul was slated to go to the Lakers with Kobe Bryant.
Right.
And they didn't let him go. He can't go to the Lakers. He can't have that powerful team in Lakers. But you can go to the Clippers, which is a rival team across the way, so we make this rival happen. So Chris Paul in his career could have played with Kobe Bryant and he could have won some championships by now. So trust me, the NBA, the NFL, the baseball league, they know what they're doing, what they want. And then you got to take it to court to get that done. And last but not least, Curt Flood, they had no other active player stand up because they probably would have got ostracized or criticized and everything
else. Yeah, they were scared. You know, yeah.
When they were scared to get up there and testify.
Yeah, it was just Jackie Robinson and Hank Greenberg at the time. But then, you know, you had your Willie Mayses of the world and these people, they just did, you know, Pete Rose at that time. They were just saying, no, it's we're going to let Curt Flood, we're going to hang him out to dry. See, he challenged He challenged the league when he refused to be traded to Philly in 1969. And he wrote a letter to the commissioner. And it resulted, he sued Major League Baseball, and then that opened the floodgates for free agency. And then it really cost him his career, because when Marvin Miller and the union, and Marvin Miller was his lawyer, and they were, you know, trying to bargain at that, Curt Flood never played again. I mean, he never played baseball again,
right.
And, you know, but what we don't realize, and he never had a chance to really return to baseball, but what he did was set the tone for sports for the next 50, 60 years. You know, it just brings up the question, is there free agency in golf? Here's Curt Flood, Ralph, talking about it. And this is from Ken Burns' baseball series. And it was such a great series, but here's Curt Flood.
I guess you really have to understand who that person, who that Curt Flood was. I'm a child of the 60s, a man of the 60s. During that period of time, this country was coming apart at the seams. We were in Southeast Asia. Good men were dying for America and for the Constitution in the southern part of the United States. We were marching for civil rights, and Dr. King had been assassinated, and we lost the Kennedys. And to think that merely because I was a professional baseball player, I could ignore what was going on outside the walls of Busch Stadium is truly hypocrisy. And now I find that all of those rights that these great Americans were dying for, I didn't have in my own profession.
And then it was in 76 that pitchers Andy Messersmith and Dave McNally agreed to play without a contract. An arbitrator gets involved and declared them free agents. And that opened up, you know, and right prior to your career now. I mean, you're stepping into Virginia, you're stepping into the spotlight. And that's why I find this whole thing interesting, because what happened in the 70s, and one Ralph Sampson's getting ready to test the waters and find out about, you know, being drafted and playing and, you know, and then staying the 4 years, Ralph. So you had to be excited at that time to be drafted, but did you have a pretty good feel? And I know you had good people around you. Did you have a good feel as far as contract situations and heading to the Rockets?
Not at all. I mean, I had a good legal team and then a good agent at that point in time that knew contracts, but you know, we loaded a contract with every possible incentive that we could get our hands on.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the negotiations were easy because, you know, being the number one pick and knowing I was going to be the number one pick for 3 or 4 years straight, the Rockets came in and they rolled out the red carpet. And then it took us about a couple weeks to get the contract done. But there was all standards then. You got to understand, Magic and Bird and them came in before me. And then George Irving, those guys did it. And really, I think the Moses Malone thing helped as well, leaving Houston, going to Philadelphia, because he got traded there. So they mm-hmm. get the number one pick. So a lot of things were going on prior to me coming to the NBA, that kind of position, the free agency there, but kind of the start of what's going on right now back in that day. So it was fun to be a part of it. But when you look back, it's like all these things were going on that you didn't really understand back in the day, but now you do.
As long as I've known you, I don't think I've ever asked you this, because I lived it being part of the university at that time. People were so wrapped up in the Ralph Sampson story. And I know about the Red Auerbach visit to your house and your mom saying, no, you're going to go to college. But did you feel pressure, and did the pressure mount sophomore year, junior year, you know, after you finished the seasons, each spring, did you feel pressure mounting?
I don't think I felt the pressure. I mean, it's like playing a game. I feel pressure when I play. Not really. I'm with the ball in my hand.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the decision to make. My parents didn't pressure me. Like I said earlier, Coach Allen didn't pressure me. The teammates, you know, we had fun hanging out. But the biggest decision was, I really ready? Was I ready to go to the NBA after my freshman year? No, I was not strong enough
mm-hmm.
physically or mentally. I probably was ready after my sophomore year. But, you know, I looked at the quality of where I was going to play. You know, Indiana or a team that I didn't want to go to. You know, I wanted to play for a decent team. You know, that's why when the Lakers and Indiana had to flip, if I would have known that the Lakers would have won the flip, I probably would have came out, but I couldn't take a chance. on that. The year that Isaiah Thomas went to Detroit, it was Isaiah was like the second pick. That another Indiana might have had that pick. I didn't want to go to Indiana either. So it just depends. There wasn't any pressure. It was, and I was, Mike, I was having fun at UVA. People had to understand that, I had great Coach Allen, Odom, Larry Nagel-Page, all that kind of stuff, with great coaches. Also had great teammates. And, and even after now, after playing, retiring, and at this stage of my life, teammates are actually very special. Ricky Stokes, Bobby Stokes, good friends, Ken Nealon, that's going through some issues medically right now. And then, Terry Gates, Jeff Lamb, Lee Brake, all those guys, are still good friends.
Right.
Rick Carlisle as well. So I don't think you can buy that, in today's world with players that are playing in one and done and have the camaraderie with your teammates that we had at UVA.
Yeah. So basically you were comfortable.
I was fine. I was having fun. I was comfortable. I was on track to graduate. We had a good team. We could play and compete for national titles. So it wasn't bad.
And to think that those Virginia fans were just worrying about something and they really didn't, know.
They had to worry about a front a little bit, but at the end, after I decided my second year, okay, great. And the pressure got made, going to the Final Four, my second, maybe it's time for them to go, right?
Right.
So maybe it was more pressure my third year when I stayed. My fourth year, I was coming out anyway.
Well, hey, big fella, you cost me about 5 talk shows a day in the month of May and June. So I just want to tell you. And by the way, before we go to break, because we're going to get into the NBA side and the Oscar Robertson rule, in 1947, the NFL replaced the reserve rule with it, and they developed a one-year option. And under that rule, teams had the right to use a reserve clause one time after the expiration of a player contract, and then the option year could not contain the reserve clause at that time. And that made players free agents with no restrictions, because people say, well, what about the NFL? When did it happen? Well, the one-year option rule was instituted in 1947 and lasted until 1962.
And really, really gripes me. They go back to Bird and Magic a lot. I mean, they'll say, because they did these things. And I mean, there were some great rivalries between Russell and Chamberlain a lot of times, but TV came on then. I think the Oscar Robertson rule changed basketball.
This is Center Court, presented by the Winner's Circle Network in association with the Sampson Family Foundation.
Welcome back, Center Court, Winner's Circle Network. Ralph Sampson's here, and we are talking about free agency and the impact in sports and what is really going on today. Ralph, I'll refresh my memory and yours too, maybe. But Tom Chambers was a big part of what happened, because before 1988 in the NBA, you could be drafted or traded. Now, signing with another team after your contract was up, it was not really that the wide open option it is today, even if your team was willing to let you go. In short, there were good chances you weren't going to go anywhere. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. It became official when Tom Chambers said, look, if I don't accept it, because I feel I can get a better deal. But the league developed that you had to be in the league 7 years or more to move on, and you have played through 2 NBA contracts. And we'll talk about the 5 free agent signings that maybe affected basketball of all time. But as you were working there with the Rockets, you were comfortable in Houston, as we use that word again, right? So you weren't going to test the free agent market anyway. How long? What was the length of your first Houston Rocket contract?
First contract was 3 years.
Okay.
And so, the first 3-year contract with the first player of $1 million contract that's coming out of college. It was 3 years. And then, with a 4th-year option, if we wanted to take that. But then actually I signed after the 3rd year, I signed another contract with Houston for another 4 years. And then end up getting traded to Golden State somewhere in that second year of the second contract. And you look back at all that, and then you mentioned Tom Chambers, traded, because Tom Chambers, I was playing in one of the All-Star game, my 5th All-Star game, which I didn't get to play. I got injured that year, and Tom Chambers was the backup All-Star. So he became the All-Star, but he won the MVP of the All-Star game and took off after that with the Seattle SuperSonics. We also mentioned in the player unit, a guy named, one of the most powerful people in NBA at that point in time was Larry Fleischer. He had the union, he had everything together, and he fought for the players like you wouldn't believe, with that, you got to play 7 years and you have to do all these things. that the league wanted to do, and didn't really give the players much rights to really control their own destiny.
It was 1976, and the NBA had 18 teams now with the merger, and they agreed to a class action settlement with a players association, which ended up changing the balance of power, and players now had leverage in dealing with owners. MLB and NFL players soon won similar suits and everything, but it was Oscar Robertson who went after the rule. It was that settlement because it eliminated the option or reserve clause, and it was Oscar Robertson who fought for it. And yes, the Big O was pretty proud of that legal proceeding.
When I first got involved with it, I didn't know what the hell was going on with it, to be honest. I didn't know where I was going to go, anything at all. Just know we had a group of people. We had to get some. And during those days when you had player representatives, if you were not a good player, they'd get rid of you, because the owners didn't like that. And I think I've suffered myself because I got involved with the Players Association, and we won the case. It was 78, I believe, something like that.
76.
76. It's just something that had to happen, you know, because things were not right in basketball for a long time, you know. And just, for instance, if you were a player on the Minnesota's team, and you had your played out your option, and you didn't have a contract, they could keep you from playing with any team in the league. And that was the real thing. That was really the basis of what we were doing. And not only that, the league was trying to merge, and we felt that if the league would merge, they would cut down on player salaries. But eventually, they merged anyway. And the thing about it just went back and forth, and it was just a journey that the owners did not want the players to have any control at all of what was going on in basketball. And, you know, and they fought that tooth and nail. And look at them now. Look at what they've done, you know. Guys selling teams for $1 billion.
And that's in an interview with Kevin Garnett. So, Ralph, were you aware then? And I mean, were players were probably discussing this, buses, restaurants, like what was happening at the time in the mid 80s regarding free agency and what was happening with the NBA?
Yeah, I mean, all the time. I was actually I was a player rep for the Houston Rockets, so I was in some of those meetings. And you go all-star games and meetings. It got heated in those meetings, especially when there was time to renegotiate the collective bargaining agreement with the owners. So it was quite interesting to understand that and how it worked out. And, you know, and knowing Oscar and meeting with him a few times, you know, over the years and understanding what he went through. I mean, just think about all the guys today, you know, we cherish the guys that came before us. Mm-hmm. And all the guys that, you know, play today that's making, you know, a boatload of money. They got to thank people like Oscar and what we went through down to get there, because it has evolved over the years. And, you know, economy has evolved, the game has evolved, you know, life has evolved. But, you know, they laid the foundation for kind of what's happening today.
So Oscar was very involved with the Players Association at that time, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. He was, I mean, I didn't play against Oscar, but he stayed as a staple in the league because he voiced his opinion. And as he said in his comments right there, that, you know, because he was a part of the Players Association, some team didn't like him because he had some power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, anyway, Oscar, in continuing the interview with Kevin Garnett, said that there's no doubt his rule changed the landscape and the culture of basketball.
But I think that I like to think the guys, that there were a lot of guys involved, a lot of player reps who took a lot of heat because of the Oscar Robertson rule. And the players today, I just wish sometimes they would read up and find out what it was really all about. You know, I was doing a radio show at the All-Star game once, and this guy had me backstage and said, Oscar, you said about these things and whatnot. And I said, do you know about the Oscar Robertson rule? He said, no, I don't. And I got up and left. I said, you Google it up first. I said, I'm going to leave. I said, you don't know anything about sports. It's a funny thing that when the NBA talks about what changed the game of basketball, you know, and really, really gripes me. They go back to Bird and Magic a lot. I mean, you know, they'll say, oh, well, you know, because they did those things. And, I mean, you know, there were some great rivalries between Russell and Chamberlain a lot of times. But TV came on then. I think the Oscar Robertson rule changed basketball.
Also, the draft changed. The draft was modified, too. A player could sit out a year and re-enter instead of signing with the team that drafted him, and high school graduates became eligible, as were the right of first refusal and compensation rules, which had restricted player movement among teams. So, Ralph, at that time then, and I know last week we talked about the mid-80s and the power, and just like Oscar said, Magic and Bird and Jordan and how they changed the game, but no doubt, legally, and what was happening in free agency was certainly changing right along with it, wasn't it?
It was. So, I mean, everybody says Magic and Bird, you know, there is definitely Wilt and Bill Russell. Mm-hmm. And the robbery were there and the game there, which I think are the greatest era to play. But the game of basketball economically was going in the tank. Teams were losing money, et cetera, because there wasn't much excitement and there wasn't much flair with basketball. Magic and Bird were able to do that with their 1979 or so NCAA win that Magic won. And then they carried it over to the NBA the next year. Mm-hmm. But before that, there was great rivalries as well, but the dollars wasn't there. The TV money wasn't there. You know, all the stuff that it started happening wasn't there. I mean, my guy can remember when I was little. I used to watch, you know, the Knicks and the Celtics or the Knicks and the Lakers with Bill Russell on a Sunday afternoon game of the week, CBS in black and white. It wasn't in color. I was, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old. And you can only watch those games like that because my mom loved basketball. So, and it was delayed and the game was dull before, you know, watching it. So, you know, it had evolved from the 60s to 70s, you know, in a big way. Then it went from the 70s to the 80s in a bigger way. And the rest is history after that.
And then when did you step in with the Sacramento Kings?
I played in Rikers for 5 and a half, almost 6 years. 80, 73, almost six and a half, almost 7 years. And then I went to the Golden State Warriors and the Sacramento Kings after that.
Right. And you know, people don't realize, and I don't think people realize that you were fighting foot and knee issues. And you had a period of somewhere a little after 86 or something, you had like three knee operations at sometime between 80, 86, 88, 87, 88, something like that.
Something like that. I can't remember when, but it was during six and a half, 7 year, the fourth year, I had my first knee operation where I had a buck and handle tear in my my left meniscus, which, you know, and it's funny because, you know, I didn't trust the NBA doctors because they wanted to tape you up and let you play. So obviously I came back to UVA and Dr. Frank McHugh, which we thought was the best doctor in the world.
Right.
And so the technology back then was, oh, just cut it out, you know, and a Houston doctor actually wanted to stitch it up and see if it would grow back, but they didn't have any history that it would grow back. And so, you know, I didn't want to play. If I'd have stitched it up, I'd have stood out a year probably. But again, you know, a meniscus tear is probably the worst injury you could have. You know, you can get ACL, which you can now reattach and all that kind of stuff. Even you look at Clay Thompson that had, you know, all the injuries he's had, and he's back to playing as well. So technology has totally changed, but I ended up being bone on bone after that first injury. Oh. And then it kept just chunking away. And then obviously affecting my right leg, where I ended up having three knee operations, two on my left and one on my right, before my career was over.
Tough time?
It was a tough time. It wasn't fun to go through. It was, and I was motivated. It took me, you know, we had gone to the finals the year before, and I wanted to get back to playing. So I spent like 8-9 weeks, you know, really, really hard at it, rehabbing at UVA in Houston, and came back to playing, which is probably too soon. With an injury like that, but I wanted to play, and the team, you know, they pushed a little bit that we got to get back. And I probably should have sat out the rest of the year and got my leg better, you know, than it was, but I wanted to play. And that's what the league was. I mean, we played with stitches in our eyes and, you know, broken fingers and stuff like that. Today guys would not play at all because they valued the asset more with teams.
I'm tired of the conversations. I'm tired of all this stuff. I actually do feel bad for him for once. We're here to play, and you're talking about some event that happened last week.
Well, there's events going to be going on now for the next foreseeable future.
I know, but you can't drive a car looking in the rearview mirror, can you?
The Winner's Circle Network and the Sampson Family Foundation present Center Court with Hall of Fame basketball star Ralph Sampson. Again, here's Ralph and Mac.
Welcome back. This is Center Court on the Winner's Circle Network. Mac McDonald and Ralph Sampson as we hammer out free agency and really the history of free agency and how it's affecting the feud now with the PGA Tour and the LIV Tour. The LIV Tour decided, a Saudi Arabian tour with a Saudi financial fund, to say, hey, we're going to give players not only hefty guarantees. Imagine if you were still playing basketball and somebody said, hey, Ralph, $200 million if you just come be a part of our league. You'd probably find a way, right?
you either find a way or you figure it out. I mean, Tiger Woods turned down $1 billion to go play in that tour, and some other players have, but some of them have taken it on because they didn't make that type of money that Tiger Woods has made.
It's been an amazing story to follow for the last couple of weeks because immediately the PGA Tour stepped up and said, okay, we're going to suspend 17 players who have said, hey, we're going to this tour. And Greg Norman has some issues. He thinks that the PGA Tour has been a money grab. But now guys like Rory McIlroy and Justin Thomas are saying, hey, we support the PGA Tour and what it means. And yes, there are, in fact, and I have one footnote to this. I had a PGA member, and I won't release his name, but I had a PGA member agreeing to do an interview. How big a story is this? He called me 6 hours later last night and said, Mac, I'm not going to be able to do it. I just don't feel good about it because of my PGA membership, and I don't want to say the wrong thing. They're friends with the PGA Tour. They're two different entities, but the PGA supports, of course, the PGA Tour. Anyway, Rory McIlroy supporting the tour and thinking that for the guys it is a money grab, but he thinks it's an easy way out. Listen.
Friendships aside, is there any part of you as a player that looks at those joining as not so much surrendering, but almost recognizing they're not going to be as competitive or can't be as competitive? And do you lose respect for that?
No, I understand. Yes, because a lot of these guys are, you know, in their late 40s or, you know, in Phil's case, you know, early 50s. And I think everyone in this room, and they would say that, say to you themselves that their best days are behind them. And that's why I don't understand for the guys that are a similar age to me going, because I would like to believe that my best days are still ahead of me. And I think theirs are too. So that's where it feels like you're taking the easy way out.
The Saudi money, which has affected a lot of people who follow the PGA Tour, they don't feel, you know, they feel still very connected. A lady who runs the 9/11 Coalition for Families wrote a letter to Phil Mickelson and said, do you realize you're partnering with people who killed Americans on American soil, 9/11? And so that is part of the whole controversy. And then when you've got the other players going, well, it's a money grab, it's not a money grab. But the PGA Tour has a policy and a policy board saying you can't play on another tour. Exhibitions are fine. And even though now it's a definition, is this an exhibition or not? You know, Ralph, imagine being an independent contractor. You're your own businessman now, basically. But imagine if you were with a team and you wanted to go play in an exhibition, unless there were rules garnering it saying no, it would be kind of hard for you not to go, right? And especially in a golfer's world.
Well, especially in the golf world. So the PGA needs to and I'm sure they have some type of agreement with them, like you stated, but they need to put them on a contract and pay them a certain amount of money just to be on their tour, which I'm sure they do something and have some type of compensation. Like the NBA, you go to a team, you're the property of that team, basically, and you get a contract. Now, think about the guys that play in the CBA or the G League or the Gatorade League, whatever they call it these days, and they go up and they get a 10-day contract. So they are independent contractors at that point. They get an 10-day contract. They may get two 10-day contracts. But if they had the rights to go overseas and make money, I mean, everybody wants to play in the NBA. So the PGA is like the NBA. Everybody wants to play in the PGA because that's the world's best golf tournament, right? But at some point in time, I mean, especially the money that they spend out, somebody's going to jump ship. It's going to be either a lawsuit from the PGA to a player or something like that. But somebody's going to jump ship because they're throwing around a whole lot of money. And some guys, as the gentleman just said, if I'm long in the tooth and ladder in my career and I'm going to try to win another Masters or PGA, is it possible that I can do that? Or I go make this $50 million.
Yeah.
You know, and I know it's our rights in the country and Saudi versus United States and 9/11. I get all that. And Tiger has a great statement about that. But you know, you got to weigh it for your future and your family. And the first thing I would look at, go say to Mac, I had a deal with the NBA, a guy named Otis Bursum last year, like Christmas holidays. And they were trying to get, and this is why this stuff has come out, a deal to go play golf for $100,000 for 3 days in Saudi Arabia. And it was during the holiday season. Like, okay, great. It never came to fruition, but they were pushing that very hard at that point in time. So now it has evolved to where it is today, and it's kind of crazy to see what's happening.
So there were NBA guys being offered money to go play in Saudi Arabia as part of an NBA golf, like, get-together, celebrity tour?
Exactly. We just go play a captain's choice game, whatever. Artis Gilmore, Otis Birdsong, George Gervin, et cetera, et cetera. You know, which they had called me and said, okay, big fella, we want to go over and play. And they had some, if you look at the notes in there, they had some entertainers that people drop out. And they end up calling the NBA guys and try to see if we want to come over. But it never happened. They never got it off the ground.
How about that? Well, John Rahm, of course, for U.S. Open champion, and he's supporting the PGA Tour as well. He also weighed in on what's happening with the LIV Tour.
I've never really played the game of golf for monetary reasons. I play for the love of the game, and I want to play against the best in the world. I've always been interested in history and legacy, and right now the PGA Tour has that. There's some meaning when you win the Memorial Championship. There's some meaning when you win Arnold Palmer's event at Bay Hill. There's some meaning when you win L.A., Torrey, some of these historic venues. And that, to me, matters a lot. My heart is with the PGA Tour. That's all I can say. It's not my business or my character to judge anybody who thinks otherwise. And for a lot of people, I'm not going to lie, those next 3-4 years are worth basically their retirement plan they're giving them. It's a very nice compensation to then retire and sail off to the sunset.
But this week, with the U.S. Open being, you know, just one of the bigger tournaments in a Brookline, it was very historical. You know, it's part of what the USGA, that's one of their 5 charter clubs. And Phil Mickelson, when he held his press conference a week ago, 30 minutes of just questions. And it was just it was a uncomfortable press conference scene. But anyway, Phil tried to explain the free agent part of it and the fact that I'm an independent contractor. To have the best of both worlds would be his major preference.
My preference is to be able to choose which path I'd like, one or the other or both. I feel that, as I was saying to Ann, I gave as much back to the PGA Tour and the game of golf that I could throughout my 30 years here. And through my accomplishments on the course, I've earned a lifetime membership. I intend to keep that and then choose going forward which events to play and not.
So it's going to continue to be just a deep dive and discussion. Right now, the LIV Tour, I think they've got 6 more events, if I've got my numbers right. 5 of them are going to be in the United States, including their season-ending event, which is going to be in Miami. It's still going to be a conflict. There's still going to be a lot of talk, and it's one of the major stories this summer. The British Open comes up. Phil's going to go play in the British Open. And so stick with the free agency. And in summary, today bringing to the table the story of free agency and where it sits, the big question is, and I don't know if I have the answer, but the big question is, are these guys free agents? Are they independent contractors? And should they be allowed to play wherever they want to play? And that's the big question, even though the PGA Tour has a policy that these guys have signed up with.
It's a big, big thing, Mac. I mean, what a country. United States of America is free, right? So you got some Saudi Arabians that supposedly came over and had 9/11 and killed a lot of Americans, and they come over with a lot of money and do the same thing. So it's kind of, to me, it's kind of crazy. But Phil was, you know, he's later in his career, and he wants to have the opportunity to pick and choose what, i.e. like being a free agent, I want to go and do this, I would do that. But his history in the PGA Tour is significant. He's got green jackets. Right. He's played the game at a high level. He respected the game. He's well known, and he's an ambassador of the sport. So PGA, either you step up a little bit, okay, we should give him something more. Maybe the PGA doesn't have as much money as the Saudi Arabians, but give him something that's going to help him with his retirement and career, which I'm sure he made enough money to do what he needed to do. But he's still also protecting his family, which is what he's doing. Yeah. They're going to pay him, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. He's going to look at that.
Yeah. Bryson DeChambeau said, look, I can play less golf, be around my family more, and I can concentrate on my businesses in Dallas. And that was Bryson's decision. So, but it didn't help a couple of months ago when the book came out about Phil, and he called the Saudis scary. Fill in the blank. Ralph and I come back. This is Center Court on the Winner's Circle Network.
To get into sportscasting, you need experience just to get your foot in the door. I can't tell you how many times in my career somebody will ask me, how do I get into your business? How do I become a sportscaster? The first thing I ask is, what have you done? Do you have any experience? And the answer is normally, nothing yet. It's because they couldn't find a program that provided the real-world experience that you need to get started. So I set out to create a program designed for the next wave of sportscasting talent. And my partner was an obvious one, Full Sail University. great track record in entertainment and media, great alumni group, and the ability to evolve as the industry changes. We're offering a bachelor's degree that combines the professional expertise that my fellow sportscasters and I have built our careers on with the technologies shaping the world of sports. To succeed in this business, you have to be ready for what's next. But the core of great sportscasting, I don't think, will ever change. And this program brings it all together.
I see myself playing a lot of golf, hopefully creating a lot of great entertainment for golf fans, and give myself a lot of free time for myself to be able to do things outside. Just give me the resources to go do something in Dallas, build a driving range, build a multi-sport complex, do things that I can do for my foundation, grow my education principle idea that I have, and do things in Dallas that I want to be able to do.
The Winner's Circle Network and the Sampson Family Foundation present Center Court with Ralph Sampson. Uplift, empower, educate.
Welcome back, Center Court, Winner's Circle Network with Ralph Sampson. Happy Father's Day, by the way. I certainly don't want to forget that. And with everything happening next week, you've got Massanutten Ralph Sampson Academy basketball camps, don't you?
Back at Massanutten, and this year, starting next week, the 21st, 22nd, 23rd, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday of the next number of weeks. And it's going to be fun. We did it last year. I had a ball, and look forward to this year for sure.
What do the kids look for when they come to the camp?
It just depends. There's kids that, you know, want to just have a good time, that want to get the first experience of the game of basketball at a good level. There's kids that want to get better. There's kids that are in between deciding which sport they want to go in. And then you all of a sudden have the two or three kids that may be a little bit more serious about it. So it's fun to see the dimensions of kids and how they react. But, you know, in a camp like that, that only may 15 to 20 kids, mm-hmm. I have to be very aware of what kid needs what.
Yeah.
And that's the fun part for me, to understand a kid. And by the end of the second day, I kind of know, and we built this relationship, and I can push them a little bit harder individually at that point in time.
The relationship with your father through the years, how did you become such good friends and so close? What was it your dad gave you at an early age?
Which is instilled in me today. My both parents, my dad, you know, he would work when we were growing up. He worked from 3 o'clock to 11 on the second shift, but he would make us breakfast every day and take us to school, go to work. My mom would come home and do the rest for the evening. So I learned at that point in time, his work ethic, but also his father figure that he got us dressed. He got us up. He motivated us every morning, took us to school. He not only took us to school, he took some other cousins to school as well in the neighborhood. So it started at a very, very early age with him. And, you know, sometimes he couldn't see, you know, some of the, you know, rec league games and some of the things like that unless he took off. So he missed some of those at some point in time, but he was there all the way helping out. So happy Father's Day to Ralph L. Sampson Sr. and all the fathers out there. Very special man. He'll be 86 this summer.
Wow.
And, you know, and he's just, you know, just a good person.
Did he ever paddle your backside if he could reach it? Did he ever paddle?
Well, no, he didn't, because his mother, my grandmother, Ruby, would not let him do that. And, you know, and she lived right down the street. So he got after, we would run to her, and he would say, "Don't you touch my grandkids." So good.
It was that simple. Ralph, have a great week. We'll talk next week.
Absolutely. Thanks.
All right, man. For Ralph Sampson, I'm Mac McDonald, and that's Center Court on the Winner's Circle Network.
You've been listening to Center Court with Hall of Fame basketball player Ralph Sampson. Our podcast is available on the Believe Network at BLEAV.com. Center Court is presented by the Winner's Circle Network and the Sampson Family Foundation. For more information, log on to SampsonFamilyFoundation.org. Uplift, empower, educate. Teamwork makes the dream work.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, Essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.